welcome to the John, Paul, and Mike Show. This is Paul Holmes.
John Jurisic, and we're pretty lucky to be doing this right out of the provincial legislature in Victoria.
I know. It's, you know, I was just saying to the security guy upstairs, the last time I was in this building,
we're not going to talk about that. Enough with you and the ruckus you've caused when you were a young man.
All right.
I think John, Paul, and Mike will have to go off the air.
All right, we'll leave that story for another day.
Thank you.
Coming up later on in the show, we're going to be speaking with Matt Halfhill. Now, Matt is a Victoria boy who lives in Texas now, but he actually was the first guy in the world to do a Throwback Thursday. Have you heard of Throwback Thursday, John?
I've heard of Throwback Thursday, and because of my age, and I... the entire audience of 12 can see that I'm using italics in the air. I have a lot of throwbacks to go to Thursday.
Yeah, yeah. It's a fun sort of internet meme now where people are, you know, just sort of, you know, just going old school, kicking it old school on Thursday. And it's huge. And the guy who started it, he started it for his shoe business. And he invented this thing called Throwback Thursday. Anyway, he's here. He's from Victoria, and we have him coming up later on the show. So it's going to be a fantastic time. So stick around. Before that, we have an amazing privilege to sit down with Matt Wright, who is the press secretary for the office of Andrew Weaver, MLA. For those of you who have been asleep, Andrew Weaver,
or dead.
Andrew Weaver is the first elected MLA for the Green Party in British Columbia. And Matt.
And he's been doing a fabulous job, I might add. I've known Andrew for some time. He's, prior to this job, I suspect currently, is also professor at UVic. Nobel Prize laureate, I understand, as well. I've had a chance to chat with Andrew. He is doing an amazing job, not only for the Green Party, but for the profession of MLA.
So a respectable politician.
Yeah.
Anyway, joining us now is Matt Wright. And now I know Matt from his communications consulting gig with WrightResult.com. And we've known each other for several years. So this is a new understanding of Matt. But first of all, thank you for coming, Matt. And welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much. And I think this podcast is a wonderful idea. We'll be talking about politics and new communications and how things are happening in the real world these days and engaging voters and on issues and stuff. And you guys are a great example of what's happening out there.
And no commercial interruptions.
Sponsored by.
Yes. Well, but didn't you talk about how some other broad podcasts around the world that you've listened to, Paul, the hosts simply do the advertising.
Do the ads, yeah. In fact, one of the ones that I listen to quite regularly is Stuff You Should Know. And it's huge. It's owned by a big media conglomerate. But it's just a couple of dudes, and they sit down talking about different topics. Like, I think last week they talked about how avalanches work. And they just banter. And their ads are just them going, hey, dude, like,
buy avalanche equipment, survival equipment.
Anyway, I definitely recommend it. Maybe we can throw that in the show notes. Very serious topic, though. Holy cow, has communications as a thing changed in this modern era? And Matt, I know your title here is press secretary. What does that mean in 2014?
When I first came into this job, and I'll just give you some background on this, I didn't actually know Andrew prior to the election. His campaign team called me up literally 30 days before E-Day and said, you know, Andrew's being swamped with media, you know, he's doing well, but we need some organization on that. Would I come in and just help out for a bit? And I think you get the idea of the role of a press secretary, and especially during a campaign and post-campaign as well, you're literally at the shoulder of your MLA, you know, 24 hours a day.
Well, you've been doing then an amazing job, because it appears as though on every single issue that Christy Clark talks about, Andrew is asked for an opinion. One man versus a 30-man NDP caucus.
Well, and I would say not even that. When... I hear more from Andrew Weaver, I think, especially on local media, which makes sense, I guess, because he's here, but certainly more than I hear from the NDP, which blows my mind.
Yeah, so just going back to what I was saying there is you have to have a very, very good and close relationship with the person that you're working with. And the standard sort of definition of a press secretary, of course, is dealing with media. Well, how do we define media in the modern age? Yeah. It's not just going up to Keith Baldry at Gold Global and trying to pitch a story and getting him on, you know, on TV or on the radio. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with the wild west, I call it, of social media. So we were joking around when we were making up our business cards, you know, instead of press secretary, it should be like, you know, chief of operations of engagement or something else like that, because it is now a broad field. We have to do as much or even more engaging people on social media, on Twitter and Facebook, as we do trying to get mainstream media involved. And there's a back and forth, because you see it as well with mainstream media. You look at the reporters, say, the press gallery here, they're doing as much on social media platforms as they are getting their stories on, you know, in print or on the radio.
Absolutely. I'm one of that generation that essentially get all their news from Twitter and then can link through for further in-depth discussion. But it's where I'm following, for example, the entire teacher strike is through Baldry and Palmer and even yourself, and it's the discussion, the public dialogue is actually almost happening on Twitter. It's fascinating.
Well, it's happening on social media. We spend a lot of effort on Andrew's website, so there's, you know, two or three posts per week on top issues, what's happening in the legislature, what we want to pitch out there and have people realize, and they're factual. You know, here's the situation on, for instance, the Parks Act. What does it actually mean? What is this legislation going to do to impact, you know, industry and the economy and, people around the province? And we do that. And then what we found is that that's gaining an audience over the last year. Mm-hmm. You know, people are coming back from all over the province and leaving comments and posting it out and sharing it. So while working with mainstream media is vital, it's really important, actually engaging people directly on topics of interest is also really important.
Matt, let me play devil's advocate for a minute. You know, and you know me, I've been a fan of social media for a long time. But I do think, especially in politics, but in other areas as well, there's a danger that people isolate themselves and they sort of only tune in the people who share their opinion. And because everything's so quick, everything's real time, how does somebody take advantage of getting a deeper knowledge? Or have we just abandoned that as a culture? Are we just, you know, I'm just going to listen to the people who agree with me and I'm just going to ignore the rest and maybe call them names in the process. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you see a lot of that? And what's the societal impact, I guess, on that?
If you look at outside of election season, outside of campaign season, the number of people percentage-wise, basically across Canada, but it applies to British Columbia as well, who are spending a lot of time engaging in politics or reading about it is pretty low. It's like around 9-10% of the total population. Yeah. So that's a very siloed group. Mm-hmm. They're also very a very activist group, and they can be a very partisan group as well.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So you have to balance with the when you're looking at your Twitter feed, yes, you're going to get a lot of nasty comments, a lot of partisan stuff out there, mm-hmm. and you kind of have to filter that out and engage with the people who are really, really concerned about particular issues. Whether it's something like the ALR, the Agricultural Bill, which had a huge resonance across the province, right? And people were coming back and forth on that one, and they really wanted to engage. They wanted to understand what the impact was and maybe what the potential solutions were. And that to me was one clear example of, yes, you know, maybe 1-3% of that was really hyper-partisan and you know, kind of angry and nasty. But the vast majority of it were people who were coming back to anyone who had relevant information and maybe a little bit of power to, you know, change it around or highlight something on that to find out what was going on. I thought that was a really positive moment.
So you raise a really interesting point then, Matt, because, you know, before the show we were talking about youth engagement and how that's changed. And clearly it's not just about engaging youth, but engaging citizens generally. I think because of that noise of the you know, and the veracity of the Is that even a word? Veracity? Did I just make that up?
Well, whatever. It's a good word.
It sounds like good. I'm going to use it now.
I'm going to try to use it today somewhere. I'm going to be eating my lunch with a veracity that I haven't had before.
Perfect. Perfect. Okay. So, veracity. Look it up, kids. But you know what I mean. It's hard to kind of get down. It, for somebody who's maybe not engaged, they're maybe going to look at this and just say, whoa, I'm not going to enter that fray. I'm not going to get involved in that crazy, extreme, you know, rhetoric and anger that, you know, these people are throwing out on their Facebook and their Twitter. And I've done it. And I'm a pretty politically engaged person. And I've seen somebody make a comment on Facebook and I'm inclined to sort of, you know, say to them, like, you're just dead wrong about this. But no, you know, but I don't. And I don't because, you know, I see it as being a negative thing towards, you know, building a culture in our society where we can still share ideas and not kind of be in trouble for doing it.
There, if you're looking at the youth vote, okay, or youth engagement, and I say youth, you know, the 18 to 35 kind of thing. There's a lot of research out there from especially Pew Research in the States and some stuff up here in Canada about how disaffected that age group is, that demographic actually is. They're disaffected with politics as it stands right now. They're not disengaged from actual issues. And I think a lot of this is to do with how politicians themselves have behaved in the past. People look at that and they just see the antagonism during question period. You know, all the nasty stuff that goes back and forth, right? They also feel that if you want to support a, let's say a party or a group that is unlikely or is not going to be in government, then it's almost like you're powerless because in our first past the post system, whoever gains that majority has all the power, and an opposition party or an independent MP or MLA really does not have a say. But look at the people who've done really well. Elizabeth May, she's coming up to a full term here, and she has been voted the top MP, the most engaged MP in the House of Parliament twice now.
Yeah, this issue of the youth engagement, youth vote is one of keen interest to myself. I have four children. And they're all in their 20s, now early 30s. And as a father wanting to get them involved without telling them to get involved, how does one encourage them so that they do that intuitively has been a challenge. The Green Party has a set of policies and spirit and ideas that truly reflect a new age and a new millennium, so to speak. And so, Paul, to your point, certainly social media can be a very dark place, as folks say whatever they want in anonymity. Mm-hmm. But I think on the whole, there is an emergence of understanding the new communication tools and a new way of the world working that it appears you folks seem to be capturing. And so naturally it leads one to think, where do you think that can go? Clearly you're going to have a biased opinion, but do you think in the scope of BC politics that you have room to grow in what has essentially been an adversarial two-party system for, I don't know, since the mid-50s?
Oh, longer.
It's a really, really good question, John. And yes, I do think we do have the room to grow. I think people are really excited about having a third voice, if you want to say, a different voice, new ways of engaging people. But going back to that sort of youth demographic, there's two things. One, I'm delighted and amazed, whether it's Andrew, Elizabeth May, or, member of the NDP or member of the government, going into a high school and talking to kids at that age, they're not even voting age, and getting them excited about what's going on. That direct one-on-one access really opens up a new world for them. And you tend to get direct engagement out of that, which is really quite exciting. And again, going back to my point is, while youth, it's not just youth, you know, it's people our age, and we're not going to say how old we are, but we are actually that age group which tends to go out and vote. a lot more. And even our demographic age group is getting disaffected by politics. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's, yes, youth vote has always been a real, real challenge. Youth engagement has been challenging in politics. And that is the percentage of vote coming out is declining there, but it's also declining in the older demographic as well.
Well, and if you talk about people our age, and I guess we could include John in that, you know, the reality is that, we're the youth of yesterday, right? Yeah. And so we were the disaffected voters, although probably in this room, we were probably more engaged than our peers. Yeah. The reality is those are the people. And, you know, people have been trying to study this for a long time in North America, and, you know, I've heard it been suggested that, you know, it all dates back to, the downfall of the American president who, was not a crook. And, you know, we don't remember that because, that's before our time, but certainly that was the decline where people, were no longer trusting their government the same way that they had previously, and that sort of that's carried on for generations, right? And I don't know if really they were before or not, but
well, what I'm certainly hearing from my children's peers is that there's a sense of redefining how to engage with society and with government, and so far I'm not entirely seeing our old mainstream parties get that. Mm-hmm. And I have seen Green try to get that. The proverbial question then becomes, if you were to gain more power, more seats, more so-called traditional credibility in parliament, in legislature, would you revert back to that old system? And Matt, so likely Andrew should be here to answer that, but he's not. So what do you say to that?
That's always the danger, is that you get this sort of organizational structure as you grow a political party, whether it's, you know, the traditional NDP kind of side, where they're kind of held back by the traditions that they've built up over decades and decades and decades about how you go about things, both in the legislature and out in the public and things like that. Communication control. The Stephen Harper theory of engagement is, I think, really unsettling, where it's very, very centralized. Nobody at ministerial level, parliamentary secretary, whatever, can basically go out in the public without getting prior approval from a communications committee of the sort. And that really does not work. That turns people off from direct engagement. So as we're moving forward, and we don't have the ultimate game plan on this. It's not ad hoc. You know, we do have a strategy when it comes to communications and dealing with issues, but we're working on that and building up on that and making sure that as we're moving forward, we're not going to be locked into a situation which disaffects people, because that's the danger right there, right? You lose that grassroots kind of effort which actually got you to where you are in the first place.
So let's switch gears a little bit. There was
with veracity.
With veracity.
Hey,
excellent.
I've got a good closing on that. So, the almost invisible BC Liberal annual meeting happened a couple weeks ago, and I say almost invisible, except to those people who were really
who were
engaged
there.
and were there.
Would have been a good party.
I suspect so. Yeah. So in the same city, the following weekend, there was another party that went on there. Could you tell us a little bit about that one?
Sure. The BC Green Party had its annual general meeting, and they decided last year to hold it up in Kelowna, which is symbolic, of course, because our premier, you know, she actually lost her riding against David Eby in the general election, and then had to have a by-election in Kelowna to actually get her seat in the legislature. And it was really quite exciting. We have a brand new provincial council, and I can tell you this, the chair who was elected is a former councillor from Whistler. He's got political experience. He's deeply engaged. It's a professional crew on that board, and it's going to be really interesting over the next year or so to see what comes out of the party. The BC Green Party is very small, right? It doesn't have a huge amount of money. Doesn't have a massive amount of staff. It's been based on volunteers. But with the election of Andrew Weaver, John, you were talking earlier how close Adam Olson, who's the interim leader, came in his riding
in
Sanish Gulf Islands, and he was 300 votes away from actually getting in. And that shows how people, not only on southern Vancouver Island, but in the lower mainland and in the tour that Adam has just done in the Okanagan region, how many people are really interested in what this third party, this Green Party, is about.
Reaching back into history a little bit, I know that you know, the closer that you kind of get to the fringe in politics, the more it seems people are set in their ways and are very verocitous towards towards each other.
I'm so impressed. You know what? You're going to make a good politician.
I'm making new words up. Yeah. And so you get so we've heard of, and I certainly haven't experienced it firsthand. We've heard of the infighting within the Green Party between different factions, you know, be it the extreme environmentalists versus, you know, the labor supporters and things like that. And to somebody on the outside, you kind of just scratch your head, like, you guys kind of got a good thing going. Why are you just getting along better? But I'm sure on the inside, like, this is really important stuff. So I guess, first question then is that still an issue? And if so, what are the steps that are being taken to resolve that? And secondly, like, as an outsider, why are these issues so important that they would divide people in such a small party to begin with?
It's a very good question, Paul. The challenge is when the Green Party's been around in British Columbia for around 30 years.
Yeah.
And it's always been built on the grassroots kind of activist movement, whether you're talking about what happened in, you know, Cathedral Grove, you know, forestry issues, all that kind of thing. It's been very, very activist driven. And there is a transition period when you're going from that activist movement into a political party, which is requiring, you know, a little bit of adjustment. People have to get their heads around, not only members of the party, but also people who are interested in voting for maybe a green movement of some kind,
mm-hmm.
right? On the one hand, you can't deny the history of how the BC Greens got to where they are today.
Right.
But you also have to, there's a political reality around how a party actually has to operate structurally, dealing with the legislature, right? I think one thing is really fundamental and is people, like you said, you have to kind of scratch your head around this. These aren't fist fights on the AGM floor or the convention floor. That's one thing. there are passions around certain issues, what the priorities should be for the party.
Right.
And instead of trying to subdue those or put them behind closed doors, the Green Party does have a tradition, and we want to keep it very open so that people realize that there's real debate going on. That if you're joining in or you're coming into the discussion, you're not going to be slapped down because somebody else with maybe a little bit more power or whatever, or a different faction, wants to go in a different direction.
Paul, I realize we're getting close to the end of our time with Matt, so maybe lighten it up a bit, or Tad, and generally when I've interviewed or visited folks at the BC legislature in Victoria, which, for those of you that don't live here or haven't seen it, is an iconic old building from, I believe, 1800s, early 1900s, and there are many hidden places and spots in which
secret
in which
passageways?
In which one could be placed. It's fascinating. We're interviewing Matt from a really pretty darn neat office. Can you give us a little idea of how you got this neat office? It's a really neat place for a one-man government here.
We're not complaining about this office, believe me. Okay?
Right. Sorry. Maybe we shouldn't make that so public.
I don't want the clerk coming down and going, "You guys are moving now." Okay?
Right.
You're over in the bunker, which these guys can see out of the window.
He's not listening.
He's not listening. The way I would look at it is like this. There, to gain party status within the BC legislature, you actually have to have four elected MLAs. That gives you caucus. So officially, and this caused some confusion in the early days after Andrew got elected, if you're watching Hansard or you're seeing some kind of transcript, he's described as an independent. But he is a member of the Green Party. He represents the Green Party in the legislature. So I think That was something new for legislative staff and the speaker's office and the clerk's office to actually wrap their heads around, you know, right? And they were very kind to us. We were very quick after the election to come in here and start setting up because we wanted to hit the ground running. It was a big learning curve to get in. And the clerk decided, well, we have this office available. Would you like it? So we got that. Just as to Paul's point here about secret places.
Yes. Tell us more.
Not many people know that the legislature actually has a jail.
Really?
Yes. And it's being used as a storeroom right now. And it was never officially used. Nobody was actually put in there. But, yeah, there is actually down the passageway here is, you know, a room with a set of bars across it. And it was the ledge jail.
Wow. And I bet you that's a really... pretty cool place to be on a Saturday night. Matt, thank you so much for being here on the show. I know you're going to be joining us later in the show on This Week in Politics, but just wanted to say thanks. And wow, what an amazing job you're doing. I'm hearing your boss's name an awful lot. And so that's clearly a reflection of some great work. So thank you again.
Well, thank you, John and Paul, and you know, good luck with the podcast. I think it's a fantastic idea, and I look forward to listening to it.
And interviewing you again down the road.
Anytime, it'll be my pleasure.
John, we've got an old friend of mine from Victoria, Matt Halfhill, and I was kind of blown away because Matt appeared... or his name appeared in name on CNBC this last week.
Well, and you got to tell us. You got to tell us why, because I, Matt, I've now met you via Skype. How you doing?
I'm doing very well. How about yourself?
Good. Fantastic. Good. And you told me that he was the starter of something pretty darn exciting.
Well, first of all, Matt is the founder and publisher of NiceKicks.com and the president of NiceKicks Retail. Essentially,
a nice guy,
a shoe genius.
Yes,
a shoe aficionado. Could we say that, Matt?
Yeah, sneaker aficionado, sneaker enthusiast, all of the above.
Awesome, awesome. And so, Matt, I believe it was it in 2006 when you started the internet trend that we're about to talk about?
Yes, it sure was. It sure was. But it actually, I owe a lot of thanks to my childhood and my time in Victoria for it. But I'll let you get into it.
Yeah. So Matt's obviously younger than us, and
almost everyone is.
Almost everybody is. Yeah, I know. I actually had the privilege of working with with Matt back when I was in the. In the web development business, and we helped a little bit on SEO and a few other things. And Matt made the natural transition to social media and started something every week, every Thursday, called Throwback Thursday, hashtag TBT. And this thing now is absolutely colossal. I would say, and Matt, maybe you know, I would say probably bigger than Follow Friday, and some of the other sort of routine hashtags that we see pop up every week.
Yes, it is actually the most used hashtag. I found this out just recently when being interviewed from somebody about the trend. And it's also, I guess it's also worth noting that I also started the longest, it's still the longest, the record for the longest hashtag in Twitter history to trend at the number one spot worldwide.
Oh, what was that?
Hashtag shoes I would wear instead of getting Snooki pregnant.
Wow.
So,
are we allowed to say that on the show?
So yeah, and actually what happened was, you know, we just, you know, I like to take current events and things like that, and put a sneaker spin on them with my social media audience. And what we found out by doing that hashtag, it caught on like right away. But we actually broke the news to a lot of people that Snooki was pregnant, and that was part of the reason the thing just blew up. Was that was the first people had heard, like, Snooki wasn't even trending. I just saw a blip of it on, I can't remember if it was TMZ or MTV, had confirmed that Snooki was pregnant. I'm like, oh, There are a lot of shoes I would want to, you know, I would rather wear than getting her pregnant. So just launched it.
So which shoe won?
You know, it was a battle between Crocs and Skechers Shape Ups.
Do people still wear Crocs? Is that a thing of the past now?
Well, in a sneaker world, it's like one of the seven deadly sins to own a pair of Crocs.
I'm proud to say I'm not wearing my Crocs right now.
What kind of size of Twitter following do you have, Matt?
We just cracked 424,000 just today.
Wow. Wow, that's more than you and I combined, John.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you're going to be 424,001 after this.
Right on. No, this is great. And so, Matt, you grew up here in Victoria.
Yep.
And you started this business, and I remember those days well. We had the opportunity to go to a conference in Las Vegas when you were a client of mine, and I remember inviting you out for a drink, and you had to respectfully inform me that you weren't actually old enough to drink in Las Vegas.
Yes. So that took some big adjusting coming from Canada, you know, where I was legal age, and because I moved to the United States. It was actually 10 years ago this day that I closed on the house, and my wife and I moved down, and I remember I went to a gas station, grabbed a six pack. I walked up to the counter and they asked me for ID, and I just had this, like, deer caught in headlights look like, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to walk this back because I forgot I can't buy this here.
Yeah. So Matt, I guess as a successful entrepreneur who made his success by moving away from here, I wonder if you would have, because, you know, one of the things we do on the show here, we talk about technology, but we also talk about politics as well. I wonder if you would have some thoughts around how the next generation of entrepreneurial-minded folk coming from Victoria here, what we have to do in this province and in Victoria in particular to keep people like yourself from feeling like they have to move away in order to build a successful business enterprise.
You know, from the get-go, it was something as small as, you know, getting a business license was not an easy task when I was in Victoria. I was walking to the Saanich Courthouse or municipal building and having to stand and waiting in a long line with the paper and, you know, having this, I want to say it was like almost $100 or $50 to basically start my business and, like, legally, you know, register the name. And, you know, now I'm sure you can do it online now, but at the time that wasn't available. You know, and then just other things that, you know, kind of got in the way. It just seemed like everything was just a little bit more difficult than it should be, whether it be getting a business bank account, you know, finding commercial space for lease. Everything was just like a little bit of a step harder, you know, and that's what we really noticed the difference between Victoria and Austin, Texas.
No, that's great. And, you know, like, for me, it's a passion. I grew up here as well. As you know, I've stayed despite some of those things you talked about. You know, so, I mean, it's important to kind of get that perspective. I got to ask you, though, being a man from Austin now, do you take in South by Southwest?
Oh, my gosh, do we ever. I love South by Southwest. It's like a gigantic playground. I mean, it really is so much fun. And the thing is, in the music, our business does a lot with music, but during the interactive portion, that part has gotten so big. And, you know, Twitter basically had their big launch here. I mean, you know, it was just in beta really before it came to Austin. That's where it took off. And, you know, there are a lot of great tools that kind of get unveiled at South by Southwest. So it's always a fun and exciting place to be when that's going on.
Well, John and I are going to come to South by Southwest next year, and we're going to sleep in your basement. So we just
that's
wanted to give
awesome.
You the heads up on that.
You're going to need some big beds.
Well, hey,
TMI.
Matt, it's been awesome catching up, and huge congratulations on the success of your business. For those who are interested, we've got the link to the CNBC mention, and a link to your website in the show notes.
And we're going to try to publish tomorrow, which will happen to be hashtag...
Hashtag Throwback Thursday. So we'll do a Throwback Thursday to Matt and my Las Vegas non-drinking trip.
Yes.
Right on, Matt. Have a great one.
Thank you.
Very nice meeting you.
Nice meeting you, too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hopefully we'll hear from you again.
Yeah.
Oh, no, definitely. Thank you so much. I mean, this is this is the first time I've actually spoken about it. So you guys got the worldwide exclusive on Throwback Thursday.
Woo! Oh, that's so cool.
Thanks, yeah. Matt. I appreciate it. And we're check out if you're not already finding us on Twitter. I've actually got a separate Twitter handle for the show. It's at John Paul and Mike.
Uh-huh.
And Mike is M-I-C. It's not actually a person. It's just the microphone.
Oh,
yeah. But, that's what we do up here in Victoria. Yeah. We give life to microphones. Take care now.
No, thank you.
Okay,
talk to you soon. Bye.
It's time for This Week in Politics, our thoughtful reflection on the headlines that you've been hearing all week. And, John, you're up.
Well, I hope we never get to the point where we're extraordinarily thoughtful.
No.
We've got to be contentious.
Well, this is why I said
we've got to be controversial, or else we wouldn't be BC boys.
Well, and this is why sometimes we bring guests in, so that if we're particularly thoughtless that week, then we've got somebody to carry the weight for us, right?
Excellent. Well, we have an extraordinarily honorable and well-respected guest today, and that being Matt Wright. Matt being the press secretary for Andrew Weaver, MLA, the only member of the Green Party in our legislature. And there was a lot of activity in the last week to 10 days of this session. And one of them, and maybe this could start our dialogue, was passing a bill around changing some components of the ALR, which in my understanding hadn't been changed in close to 40 years. So very curious about your thoughts about that and other pieces of activity.
So what I want to know firsthand is if you want contention on your radio or your podcast here, who's going to take the government side and who's going to take the opposition side? Paul and John, I'm going to throw quickly back to you on this one.
Well, I've been asking if John Horgan could be our guest for now 2 or 3 weeks. And with each passing week, I'm getting increasingly angry that he's not replying to me. So I was going to play the NDP, but I don't know for how much longer I can do that.
I'll play the NDP. You can play the government. Yeah, yeah. All right. Shoot.
Okay, Paul, so I want to see your private members bill, but anyway... It's been a very interesting session, for the spring parliamentary period. We began in February and ended up just last week, the end of May, with Parliament rising. Close to 25 bills were put through, some contentious, some that got cross-partisan support. I'd say three which, kind of fell under the radar, but were vitally important and had a lot of support. One was the changes to the Liquor Act. It probably didn't go far enough that a lot of people wanted, but it's a good first step, and they'll be going back to that into the future as well, just to see how that falls out.
And that's the first time they changed it in how many years? Like, the last time it was changed, like 40 years or something?
No, I don't think that long. There have been amendments to the Act that have happened over the past a number of years, number of decades of that, but they've been small and incremental in a sense. The other one, which is historic... and really got good support and a good debate around that as well, is the Water Act. Because we haven't had water regulations in British Columbia, unlike the rest of North America. And it's vitally important here if we're going to be heading into... Christy Clark's our premier's idea of LNG, because there's a lot of water issues around that.
Yeah,
right.
And I think people are also recognizing the impacts that we're having right now on climate change. And I think the Water Act is really, really important because while we in BC have we're blessed with glaciers and water resources that are the envy of many jurisdictions around North America, we can recognize that in the future we may not be so blessed. So getting control of that right now, I think, is very important. And that was an historic piece of legislation. And, of course, there were some contentious ones as well. So I'll just throw it back to John on that.
Well,
are you speaking as the government now?
No. I'm speaking as John, who tried to steal the microphone from Matt. What was unique, I found, besides obviously the content and policy, was that the odd time the Green Party and through Andrew Weaver agreed with government. And we've spent so much time expecting the opposition to disagree with whatever the government says that it's become predictable. And in fact, your MLA is not that way. How has that been received? What sort of public reaction have you had to that kind of, God forbid, respectful behavior in the legislature?
Well, John, I like the way you put that, respectful behavior, okay? There has been a tradition for any opposition party just to be the party of no, that everything the government puts out there is bad. Even if the government tends to borrow the ideas of an opposition party and claim them as their own, you're still going to get no because we're upset it used to be our idea. Andrew has come into the legislature, and our entire team is behind him on this, the idea of doing politics differently. So you can say no to something. You can say no to what's going on, for instance, with the ALR Act, what was happening with the Parks Act. But unless you've got something to put out there as a different pathway or a different resolution on there, that is another way of turning people off, right? What you want to do is have a considered debate around the province and real engagement to determine where the province wants a piece of legislation to go. The ALR, one of the reasons it was so contentious was, despite the claims of the government that they had consultation with the province, they didn't do it. So people were really surprised and quite angry when these changes were proposed. Contrast that to what they did with the Liquor Act. It was the biggest piece of government engagement in their history. They had over 15,000 responses over a three-month period. There was a lot of back and forth and a lot of positive on that. And that allowed them to put in some controversial changes around how liquor is sold, how it's distributed, what you can do in terms of getting licenses to drink in public places and things like that. But the consultation was done, and the public was not surprised. So I think a lesson has to be learned from both opposition and government to say, if you get out there in front with the public before you introduce a bill and you get social license to go ahead with something, then you're going to get a far more positive experience out of it.
Why is that such a no-brainer? I think back to the consultations that Gordon Campbell did around the HST, which was none.
Yeah.
Well, or perhaps telling an untruth about it and then changing his mind, or however that all went down. It's ancient history now, right? But, you know, how is it that governments haven't learned this? Because you're absolutely right. If you can get the engagement and get people on side and they buy into the idea, sure, you're going to have opposition. You always will. But at least you've got people thinking about it.
And I think the HST is a classic example, because one of the reasons that petition and the referendum actually worked was it wasn't necessarily that people were against the concept of the tax reform itself.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of small businesses,
yeah,
who were small business members. I'm one as well. I have a consultancy.
Mm-hmm.
The HST would have actually been a better fit for the type of business that I was in previously. It was the problem of the lack of consultation.
Yeah.
It was the process that they went through to actually impose this without getting some kind of public engagement and debate beforehand.
Yeah.
Now, any government coming in is going to have some difficult policy decisions to make. Some stuff that may or may not be, you know, acceptable to the majority of the people in the province that you represent. And what they tend to do is early on in the session is get rid of all the hard stuff. So by the time you're nearing the election, you can throw out some softballs there, right? So that's why the spring session now and the fall session, which we will be having for the first time in a long time, actually,
yeah,
coming up in October, are going to be very contentious and fraught in the House, because there's a lot of controversial stuff that has happened in the spring session and will be coming up next time as well.
So I have a shifting gears a little bit, actually a lot. I have a question. Is Antarctica melting?
Is Antarctica melting?
Paul?
Yes.
We're in This Week in Politics. We're sitting in the BC legislature.
Did you not see the news? Antarctica is melting. And when Obama announced his new caps on regulations around the coal industry in the United States, certainly on social media, the NASA photos of Antarctica appearing to melt, and I'm not a scientist, I know nothing, but it looks
okay,
pretty,
now that's
looks
some
pretty
context.
Obvious.
Thank you.
Looks
for
pretty
project.
Obvious. So what's going on? Is this a good thing? Is this a move in the right direction? And how does this impact British Columbia and green politics in particular?
Well, let's just go quickly back to your is Antarctica melting here. Yes, it is. Yes, so is Greenland.
Yeah.
So is the Arctic North. More particularly in BC, I don't know if you saw the reports coming out a couple weeks ago about glaciers in BC that were likely to lose the Comox Glacier on Vancouver Island within the next 25 years. That's going to have a huge impact on watersheds. We're losing glaciers in the Rockies as well. So it goes back to the impacts of climate change, not only globally, but directly here in the province. And it's not something that can be ignored. Very interesting what Obama did about coal-fired power plants.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of impacts on that. One is he recognized right away that within the United States, around 39%, maybe even a little bit higher, of all their greenhouse gas emissions come from coal-fired plants. That's not really a big issue in Canada because we already have some regulations around that. And the amount of emissions coming from our own coal-fired plants, mainly in central Canada and back east, is around 10 to 12%. And we have targets on that. What Canada needs to do, and people have been pressing for this, is where our problem is, and that's in the oil and gas industry. Because that accounts for a good 30% of our greenhouse gas emissions.
Right.
The other side of it is something that's really controversial, and it does impact us here on the islands as well, is California, Oregon, and Washington State have basically put a ban on thermal coal exports going through their states and out their ports off to markets in Asia. That means that the only real West Coast port to get that done is through British Columbia. And we've seen a massive increase of U.S. thermal coal coming out from places like Montana, being shipped by train into Fraser Surrey Docks, out through the Tawasin area, and onto Texada Island. And if we're going to be leaders on this, and if we want to have a profile of British Columbia being an environmentally sustainable and sound place, why are we doing this? Why are we shipping out all our dirty coal, U.S. dirty coal, off to China, off to Asia, where the pollution is not only affecting them directly, I don't know if you've seen pictures of Beijing over this winter, right?
Yeah.
But that pollution eventually does make its way over here as well. Mm-hmm. So welcome news from Obama. He's recognizing it. He's taking a leadership role on the impacts of climate. And interesting politically, too, he's doing it basically ordering council, we would call it here in British Columbia, without going back to his
right.
Congress and
right.
saying, because he knows it would just be held up.
Nothing would happen.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've heard a couple of times is all the people driving their coal-powered cars here in Victoria, they're plugging in their electric cars to the grid, and some of that power inevitably is coming down the pipeline through dirty sources. So, and, you know, one side would say that that's a waste of money. Another side would say that, well, you got to start somewhere. Right. So are you on the you got to start somewhere side of that equation, I assume?
Well, certainly. And there's another controversy that's here in BC, and it's ramping up, into some heated debate. And that's Site C Dam. Now, on the one hand, you can look at that and say hydroelectric power is clean. It is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Once it's built,
yeah. Of course. But you have massive impacts as well. You're flooding a valley. You're flooding areas where there's traditional native hunting grounds is one.
Yeah.
And then you look at the cost of doing that. $8 to $12 billion is the estimate right now. First of all, do we need that power? And BC Hydro really has not come up with a case. In fact, the Utilities Commission said, BC Hydro's argument that the power is needed now and into the future has not really been demonstrated. And secondly, if you're looking at moving away from what we call a carbon-intense economy, which is essentially what we have now, you know, we're in a Wild West moment of trying to dig everything we can out of the ground and getting it off to any market that'll have it. That's not sustainable. Whereas if you look at what we could do with a clean tech industry, and that's anything from wind to tidal to geothermal and stuff like that, that's distributed around the province. It creates more jobs. It gives you a more resilient power economy, and it should be the way of the future. In fact, BC should be leading on that and not trying to play catch up with places like California, Washington State, and even the direction that China's going now.
This guy's making way too much sense.
Told you he was a smart guy.
Yeah, I can see why your thinking and philosophies are gaining momentum, not only in BC, but across the world. With this theme of This Week in Politics, let's talk a little bit for our listeners just about sort of the mechanics of some of what happens in the legislature. There's a where the MLAs meet and speak, generally we just see the sort of confrontation around question period. Within the last week or so, I believe there was a member thrown out of the legislature during the debate on ALR. Was curious about your thoughts on, not your thoughts as much as the emotion around that. And one man parties or independents, one person parties are generally put way to the back. They sit somewhere where no one can see them. They have a little, why is it that Andrew seems to be able to get, a front page and primetime, exposure? What are you guys doing right that it seems a stream of one-person parties haven't done in the past? So just a bit around what actually physically goes on in there would be really great for our listeners.
There's a set of rule books called standing orders, and this is what you can and cannot do under parliamentary procedure. And there's a lot of little ways and protocols you can use to get your voice heard in the House. And I'll give you an example. This hadn't been done in well over a decade, which is when the government sits and opens up the parliamentary session, there's a throne speech. So that's given out by the Lieutenant Governor, and then you have a debate on the throne speech. But what you can actually do is propose an amendment to it. So you're asking the government to add something to it or in terms of the direction that they are going.
You folks did that, didn't you?
And we actually did.
Yeah.
Yes. And this was it was fascinating and it was funny at the end of the day too. The amendment was actually to look at thermal coal and ask the government to find ways to actually put a cap on it or restrict it in some way. And so Andrew proposed that. The Liberal government, of course, said, no, we're going to vote against this, but also did every single member of the NDP. So it was 73 votes to one against Andrew, right? Which actually put the opposition into a bit of a quandary because they're actually voting for the government on thermal coal, right? The irony is quite telling. In terms of the other part of your question, the opposition controls the amount of time that every MLA on the other side of the House has in terms of when they speak, when they can speak, how many questions they get in question period, private member statements, things like that. So you're constantly going back to the opposition House leader and saying, this week I would like to have a question on something. Can you get me a time for that? And there's a back and forth that has to happen to make that work. So yes, you're looking at the theater of question period and it can get quite intense and emotional. That in reference to Nicholas Simmons, the member for Powell River Sunshine Coast, he got a little frustrated with the government on the ALR and used some unparliamentary language.
Oh, I see the language.
And the speaker actually had to ask him to leave the House. Mm-hmm. Then he wanted to vote on it, so he actually apologized and came back in.
Right.
That
technically speaking, do they actually apologize outside of the House?
Technically, they actually have to indicate they're going to apologize and then come back in and actually formally do it so it's on the record.
Okay.
Yeah. So you see the theater in question period, right? And it can get quite emotional sometimes, and sometimes it's funny as well. There are jokes that go back and forth. But you go into the hallways afterwards or in the offices, about working together on some things, cooperation on amendments, for instance. Who's going to speak to what and when? And it's all very civil. So
surprising.
Yes and no.
Yeah.
And that works also, but not only with the opposition, by the way, but in the way that we work with ministers. So we've worked very, very closely, for instance, with the Minister of Environment, Mary Polak, especially on the local sewage issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So speaking of intense and emotional, we're going to wrap up This Week in Politics with John's favorite topic, this ongoing labor dispute with the teachers. We talked it to death last week.
And of course, you're teasing.
Yeah.
This is one of yours that can set you off. I have been very impressed, however, with your objectivity on this issue. Well done.
So I have come out in full support this week of the students. The students organized a Facebook walkout. And I remember distinctly in 1989, when I was in grade 11, without the help of Facebook or the internet, basically using the telephone and the traditional media, there being an organized student protest and walkout, because of all the labor strife that was going on that year. So I salute the students. Their, you know, education is what matters here. Despite what the BCTF and what the BC government would say, nothing is more important than the education system that is, in my opinion, systemically failing kids in this province. So I guess, Matt, am I on the right page here? And what's the Green Party's solution to the education system in this province?
Well, I'm really, really glad you asked that question, because we were getting emails coming into our office here at the legislature and, of course, at the constituency office from parents and from students and from teachers showing their frustration. And what Andrew did was he had good, long, hard thinking and talking to a number of people over a number of weeks on this one. And you have to remember, too, he comes from an education background.
Mm-hmm.
He's
yeah.
a professor at UVic.
Correct, yeah.
And he certainly has children as well who are going through the school system. He wrote a 2,500-word piece on how to do this. And the solution being, you have to look back at what has caused this problem. Over the past couple of months, the government's actually been very successful in creating agreements with, like, the Hospital Employees Union, with QP unions, yeah. with Unifor and all this kind of, without the kind of animosity and going back and forth. What is wrong with teachers? Because it always seems to come down to this bar fight every number of years when nothing gets solved. And it's actually a structural problem.
Yeah.
It's a structural problem with the way that the BCTF is organized and the way the Employers Association is organized. Also, the combination of doing wages and things like classroom composition around the same table. So, with that kind of structure in place, it actually creates a dilemma, and it hamstrings school boards mm-hmm. and school districts.
Yeah.
Separate the two. Have the teachers negotiate directly on wages with the government, and then have the districts negotiate directly on class size and composition. And the reason you do that is a one-size-fits-all approach around BC probably doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Probably it doesn't work.
Well, you're going to go further than that. Yeah. Okay, I will actually agree with you
generous.
On this one.
That was
I was being generous. Yeah. And the reason being is if you go up to Fort Nelson, they have different challenges and strategies that they need to deal with versus Metro Vancouver versus Greater Victoria versus Comox, right? So that's one way of doing it is – the Professional Employers Association, the way that structure is set up, has caused this problem. And you think about it now, Paul, you're speaking about the students. What these students today graduating this year are going through right now started when they were in grade one.
Mm-hmm.
It's been going on for 12 years since this,
yeah.
this system was set up.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be a brain tease for people to realize it's a structural problem
mm-hmm.
causing the issue. Causing all the animosity, all the strife, and there is a very simple way to solve it. I do have to say, I've had media coming up to me after we posted that out around 10 days ago. You know, kind of joking, being a little bit ironic. Well, education's not really a green thing, is it, right?
Oh, wow.
And the reason they were doing that is when Andrew posted that, within 2 days, that post had over 10,000 page views, 2,000 Facebook likes, and it's just ramping up. People are looking at that, and they're just going, wow, that's common sense.
Mm-hmm.
So why do we go down that direction?
So, first of all, John, let's link to that article in the show notes. Because, because the, you know, I've been harping on this, and John and I were off the air butting our heads about, this because, I said, this is so frustrating. Like, we got to do something to fix this. And John sort of took the approach, and I'm paraphrasing John. Good idea, Paul, but I don't think it can possibly be fixed.
Well, I think I represent a good portion of folks out there who just are so frustrated that they can't seem to even move to any kind of solution, and we're just throwing our hands up in the air, wanting it to all go away, and seemingly incapable of rationalizing how to move forward. And so my message to what was very insightful thought from yourself, and now clearly the first time I've heard it from the Green Party, is there are actual rational, non-emotive, constructive ways to maybe help this problem get fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, well, there you go. So here's somebody who's might be changing their viewpoint.
I guess the problem, though, and I'll throw this back to Matt, is at the moment, we have a very elevated, what was my word again?
Veracity?
Verositous.
Verositous.
debate, where instead of showing up with good ideas, people are showing up at meetings with knives. And so how do we get these good ideas? How on earth can we possibly get them implemented within this hostile environment? And maybe the article goes into some detail, but, you know, I'm at the moment amiss. I had what I thought was a great idea, and the response from many people on Facebook was, you're anti-union. Or you're anti-teacher, or you're, you know, and it was just this heightened level. And I had a few people accuse me of, you know, being anti-government as well. So I know I did very
well.
I did very well because, yeah, so when everybody, yeah, exactly, you know, you're onto something. So great ideas in politics don't often make it to the forefront because there's very us versus them. And I'll give you another sort of broad example. I remember when the gay marriage debate was going on in Canada, it was, this is a right, and if you don't like it, tough luck on one side, and on the other side was, you know, the Bible says, blah, 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 blah. And I was in the middle of that saying, why didn't the government just not regulate marriage? Just get out of the business, because they don't belong there in the first place anyway. Well, what I didn't realize at the time was that having an opinion that was neither one side or the other was not very popular. And so when I was blogging about it at the time, I had hate coming from both sides. And so I guess, you know, further then, how do we kind of move forward on it?
It's the common sense doctrine.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And so it is quite unfortunate that when,
Like Mike Harris.
Yeah. It's very unfortunate that when, and it doesn't have to be from a party. It can come from an organization. It can come from a independent MLA or MP or whatever. Puts out something which is really, really common sense, is entrenched viewpoints who have a organizational structure around them, like a union, like the BCTF or an employers association, start going, well, if you actually go down that road, where does that leave us? They're protecting their own turf, right? So we're in a situation right now where the ideas that Andrew's put out there, and to be fair, others have, you know, said similar things, is that's really not going to affect what's happening right now. So to deal with the employer's difficulties, what's happening here, the only way I can see out of it is binding arbitration.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have to bring somebody in like a Vince Reddy and basically say, this is what's going to happen. And instead of making like the 10-year deal or the 6-year deal or whatever the government wants, bring it down to like 3 or 4. And then in that time, you actually go back to the BCTF and the Employers Association. You look at the legislation and try and change it so the structure is better the next time around.
Yeah. Well, Matt, thanks so much for being with us here on This Week in Politics. And thank you to our couple hundred listeners. for tuning in.
I heard it was a couple hundred thousand last week.
Well, you know, I didn't want to brag.
Well, I genuinely hope that we can talk with Matt again. Certainly bringing a sense of respect and honor and logic to the political process is refreshing. So thank you for your time.
Well, John and Paul, thank you so much. And I'll say once again, good luck in your show and podcast. I think this is a wonderful opportunity for people to get a different perspective sometimes about what's happening in British Columbia politics. Thanks so much. Mm-hmm.